Today is Monday, January 18th, 2021. I'm still writing 2020 on all my vaccine appointment applications. How is everyone? It's 87 degrees.
It's hot as
in January.
Fuck. I mean, this feels like a useful comparison to the last 48 hours before Election Day, which felt like it would never arrive. Famously, this is the last 48 hours before Inauguration Day. Feels like it is going to happen any second now, that there will just be an announcement that the inauguration has already taken place and Trump is, you know, decamped for parts unknown. It feels like, I guess you can't really, it sort of does feel like an anti-climax, but of course,
yeah,
we have to suspend that thought until Wednesday when we actually see what terrible things may or may not happen. Otherwise, yeah, I'm just enjoying a pleasant summer afternoon, and everything is fine, perhaps. Alyssa, how about you?
My children are in their swimsuits playing in the sprinkler outside.
Sickening.
As as we all do in January, you know, a very normal thing. And yeah, I do feel like there's been a few little fires that have cropped up and the wind kicked up and I was like, oh.
Yeah,
no,
little Malibu, couple little Malibu fires that they kicked down. It is supposed to drizzle late-ish this week.
Yes.
That would rock.
Yes, they said we have a weather pattern changing.
Let's talk about this. But we haven't gotten into the rain much at all this year. It's been just like one thing too much for us to freak out about, I feel like. So we haven't even brought it up. This is a dry year. We had functionally no rain in October, November. December, we had the one huge downpour, that
thunderstorm.
Terrifying thunderstorm. One of the weirdest and like wildest that I have seen since I moved here.
Yeah.
And that has contributed basically all of our rainfall for this season. We are way behind.
Yep.
January is supposed to be the rainiest month of the year. It has yet to rain at all on January 17th. And we're going to get a little more, but it does not bode well for this summer's fire season, depending on what we get in March, February. But right now we are something like 5-ish inches behind where we're supposed to be.
Five inches. Yeah. I mean, it does seem like we are, as a whole, it seems like the state has sort of been staggering through the aftermath of the enormous drought, multi-year drought of the 2010s. Mm-hmm. And some years we have been getting above average or average rainfall, but the state as a whole has already seen lots of different counties fall back into drought of differing severities. So
yeah,
we're on that same trajectory, it seems like.
Yeah. This doesn't have to be as bad as 2 years. 2 years ago, we had 4.79 inches in the entire rainy season. And the average is around 14. And right now we're at 2. Mm-hmm. So with a decent February, a little bit of March, we could get into the like 6-7 inches range. But that's bad. That's really, really
bad.
That's
what happened last year, remember? It was almost all of our rain came in the spring.
But it was weird because it was the fall and the spring. The winter, we had nothing.
We had a very long gap between. But yes, you're right. It did come eventually. But we won't be that lucky.
Do we know anything about how these... I personally do not know anything about how the averages are established. Like, is it over that entire 140 year recorded history this is the average, or is it
the one that I use?
What, I don't know.
On my favorite website, laalmanac.com.
Mm-hmm.
Monthly rainfall by season takes the average going back to 1877.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to assume that whatever modern era rainfall totals are a little bit lower.
Yeah,
but back the 140 years, it's a little under 15 inches is the average.
Interesting.
And also notable that last year, this week, they declared that last year, depending on who you want to use as your record-breaking temperature judge, there's different science groups that have determined this, but it's either the warmest year or the second warmest year was 2020.
That doesn't even, so for me, that doesn't even register anymore. I feel like that is the news item that has been directly implanted into my brain since I was 10 years old. It is the warmest day, week, month, year in all of recorded history. I just take that for granted every day.
But the reason it's a big deal is because the last time this happened, everybody said it was El Nino. Mm-hmm. And this was not an El Nino year. So
it's a La Nina
year. Screwed.
I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Should be colder. Is that? Yeah. Should be colder and drier, I guess. But instead, it's just dry and hot.
Let's get into what is up with these vaccines. So Mayor Garcetti put on LA Fire Department long sleeve the other day. And he went out, he took 90, the freaking mound.
Black. It was black. It was a black shirt.
He took the mound. Yes.
He took the mound.
Big ups to Tommy L.
He's standing in the middle of Dodger Stadium. It's 90 degrees. Yes. He's wearing a long sleeve black t-shirt just so it can show that logo.
But wasn't Newsom wearing a suit? A full-on suit?
No, he was wearing like one of his bear jackets.
Oh, of course.
You know, he wears those like... He has that little logo.
Okay,
that's
cool. Yeah. I want one of those.
So
it matches the throw pillows in his office.
They made this big announcement. I think we've talked in the past about the Dodger Stadium testing site, one of the biggest in the country, that has been now converted to the largest vaccination site in the country. I think Saturday was the second day of operation. Turnout has been enormous, which is a really great sign. 4 hour waits for some people, which, like, you know, is a testament to I think they schedule it assuming that a lot of people will not keep their appointments and they just want to get as many people through the line as possible. It's a good thing that there's so much demand. Also, a lot of confusion about who is allowed to get the shots and when. So after, I think I talked about it on the show, my parents were able to get the vaccine in Florida in December because they are over age 65.
Yep.
And this was something that Governor Ron DeSantis there and in other states, they decided to prioritize people in that age group. And it led to the opposite problem of what we've had here, which is a mad scramble for the vaccine and like people not being able to sign up for appointments because so many people are trying to sign up. Here, we took the opposite approach for a long time and had the opposite problem where we were just vaccinating healthcare workers and even then only a subset of healthcare workers. And people were not getting the vaccine. We had about a 40%, 20 to 40% decline rate in that category. And that was a catastrophe. It led to some vaccines being thrown away. As County Supervisor Janice Hahn this week, I don't know if you saw that video of her absolutely rip shit over over vaccines getting thrown out. And so Gavin Newsom, after the CDC kind of made this recommendation, opened up counties to vaccinate people 65 and older and some other employment categories.
Yeah.
And a lot of counties are doing that. Ventura County is doing that. Orange and Riverside counties are both vaccinating 65 plus. I believe you can go there, even if you are not a resident, and try to get a vaccine if you're in that age group right now. LA County.
The sound you hear is all of the LA podcast 65 plus listener base departing to the freeways right now.
LA County did a different thing, which is LA County expanded the definition of what healthcare workers can get the vaccine in 1A by a lot. So now it's like acupuncturists. I think certain kinds of like physiotherapists, chiropractors, it's about 1 million people in the 10 million person county are now in tier 1A, mm-hmm. are now basically like this kind of healthcare worker. And so that, I think, is what has really led to the crush at Dodger Stadium, just like this huge expansion of what is a healthcare worker in Los Angeles. But I don't think we don't have enough vaccines right now to get into the 65 plus range. They're talking about February, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, this announcement was made within the hour, I think, mm-hmm. of national news that we just didn't have a stockpile yep. of vaccines mm-hmm. at all. And it was very interesting to, you know, hear that be discussed at the national level and then have Gavin Newsom here in LA like to roll this out. And it was kind of like, but if you're doing this, is anything else coming? Like, what's actually going to happen? And then they also announced that, you know, they would have kind of a military push once Biden is mm-hmm. in office to do vaccine delivery and administration. So then you also wonder, like, are they going to come take this site over? Does it remain under the jurisdiction of the city? You know, a lot of questions.
Yeah, I'm optimistic with the combination of a couple more vaccines potentially coming online in the next few months,
right?
Production being stepped up some degree. I mean, like, I saw people saying that the California and LA County are sort of trying to have it both ways, where they're saying it's an issue. It's the federal government. We have an issue with the supply is not what they said it would be. But at the same time, we're not getting what we have into people's
right.
bloodstreams.
We are the
we
worst.
Are almost
we are
the 46th. Worst. Yeah.
Yeah, we're almost. I'm just going to say we're the, worst.
I mean,
the biggest. We should.
Certainly. And
46 out of 50.
Inconvenient for the cities, not just the city of LA, but many cities, narratives that what they just need is for the federal government to give money and then let cities do what they do, because it does appear that this is cities doing what they do. The city government has had a lot of time to prepare for the arrival of vaccines and the city and county, and has apparently not really done very good planning for how they were going to manage that once they did appear on the scene. Maybe it was sooner than they thought. We haven't really heard anybody say that, though. Like, I feel like the response has only been the confusion of what Hayes indicated, that we don't have enough vaccines, and also we need to get rid of the vaccines that we have because they're expiring on the shelf, which seems like it's it is at cross purposes with its own internal message.
My guess is that what they didn't anticipate was how low the participation rate is among healthcare workers, among firefighters. They're having to give out little carnival prizes for people that to get the vaccine. There's still about a 40% decline rate among firefighters. LAPD, they did a poll where close to 40-45% were either saying they wouldn't get the vaccine or they were unsure. And they're, I think, in the next tier. So pretty consistently, and we were all texting about this, I don't know if these job categories are an approximation of what the general population is in terms of declining the vaccine, or is it higher? Is it lower? I'm just not really sure. I also think some people are like, I had COVID already. We 1/3 of people in LA County have had it. Something like 1/10 have tested positive for it already. I could see people like that saying, like, I don't need the vaccine. I already have antibodies. That's a huge, huge right. subset of the population.
You think they're saying no to just to make sure someone else can have it instead
sure.
of them? Yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, we won't. And then there's also all these stories of people jumping mm-hmm. in line, and the mayor answered a question about, you know, saying that they were trying to be really strict about it. But then, like, at the same event that the mayor was at, like, a bunch of people who didn't provide any documentation. And I think, like, we talked about this, too, I think, last week. It's the shaming of that is kind of just not
Pick
really
one.
That big of a
Pick
deal because
one.
The, yeah, like, We just have to get as many people to get the shots, and like that will result in many nights where they'll be like, "We have 100 shots, come get them." You know, it, and we just need to do it. I mean, it's we can't report this every time this happens.
It is pick one, but I also feel like there needs to be. I feel like there needs to be some accountability internal to the government when you talk about the preoccupation with only giving the right people, you know, quote unquote, the vaccine first, leading to a situation where, okay, we have this like air bubble of resistance to actually receiving the vaccine, creating an artificial supply or market for who can get this vaccine, even if they don't yet qualify. So by focusing so much on who are we going to give the vaccine and in what order, now you have created a system in which, again, as seems pretty typical in the state of California, the small minority of very wealthy people who live here have immense access and leverage and are, you know, so if the government has set as a priority this question of who is going to get the vaccine and how are we going to bring this pandemic to a close and for whom, then we seem to have selected a method that naturally short circuits and starts rewarding the wealthy again. And
yeah, you'll see like the wealthy private school families wanting to get the vaccine but will not actually take the vaccine.
they just want to have it.
They just want to have it.
I mean, I wouldn't knock the. I like the.
Just eject the needle onto the ground, please. They wait in line for 4 hours and just be like, right into the dirt. Okay, thank you. Drive on.
My body, my
use
choice.
It to make like a sous vide or something like that. So I don't know that. They're doing it at Dodger Stadium. They might as well have like the Dodgers just go all in and do some sort of World Series commemorative thing, like first 500,000 vaccinations.
Yes.
Some bobbleheads. That would be amazing.
They should all be out there. All the Dodgers should be out there
applauding you. Yes. As you drive by.
Make it fun. But I can't read both of these articles. I can't read the ones about Florida where they're like, there's too many people trying to get the vaccine, and now they're out. And then in California, there's not enough people trying to get the vaccine, and now they're throwing them away. It's one or the other. And the Florida option is much better.
Yep. I had to. Okay. Yes. Yeah. The story where it's like Steve Lopez looking down the barrel of a camera and he's like, this woman, this 86-year-old woman, waited in line for 5 hours and didn't get the vaccine today, but she's going to be able to get it in 2 weeks, is way better than total clusterfuck. Nobody knows who is eligible and we're literally throwing existing vaccine stock in the trash. It's not a competition.
Where we're holding back millions of people who want to get in LA County and to certain subsets saying like, are you sure? Are you sure?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Here's a toy.
It would be, like, I feel like it would be, too. One of the things that I'm kind of curious about is because we've been talking about in California, this has been relentlessly the theme of the last almost 12 months is the chaos of messaging from different government agencies, from different levels of government. And I just feel like how difficult would it be to set up a fucking Google form that individual people could go to and like answer questions about themselves, and there would be like, oh, you are in this priority.
Just like the testing.
How hard would that be? You could do that in an afternoon, seemingly.
And then it would tell you where to go on what day. We could plan it all ahead of time. I mean, it just makes absolutely... We could do it just the same way we do the testing.
I think once they have and this is where the federal government does come into play. I think the state hasn't been able to anticipate their supply going like a few months in advance. So they're totally guessing about when tiers 1C and beyond will be able to get the vaccine. But I think it could be earlier than the estimations as much as it could be later. And as soon as the production schedule is set, I mean, the fact that it was a surprise that we had no reserves is disconcerting.
Yeah.
But I think we'll have a better idea of that going forward. Meanwhile, we've talked a little about the fact that the courts are open in LA County, and the translator at the Superior Court died this week. A public defender has died.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw articles horrified that some public defenders and district attorneys moved up like maybe a tier or a tier and a half ahead of where they're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And people being like, you just like, it's good. They're exposed. They're incredibly risky situations. It is good. And some party houses got shut down, huh?
I mean, not fast enough. I was like reading through it. I was ready for some salacious details. I guess it was like they said Fairfax District. How can you have a party? It was like a couple blocks off Melrose. I guess one of those big like tear down McMansion places with like a glass roof deck or something. Yeah, I guess it was like
people with glass roofs shouldn't throw parties.
Imagine how the party would just like immediately get like so lit as soon as the utilities all get cut. So like it's just like this packed house.
You have your own glow sticks and you're ready to go.
And then suddenly all the lights and powers out. Oh my God.
Well, apparently they had plenty of notice because it was the third time. The third party that they had broken up that they finally actually turned off the utilities. And it wasn't even at the party. It was afterwards. So you have to look at like these people who are getting warnings repeatedly. LAPD is coming to their party house and saying, hey, don't do that, guys. Hey, back again. Don't do that. And then they just get the power cut out. Meanwhile, there were images that came out over this past weekend of them breaking up party, like a hookah party and like a strip club that someone had built in like an office building, which I commend them. I mean, I have to. And then you see the police arresting like tons of people in a parking lot. Not the influencers in the party house, though. They just got their, you know, power snipped.
And do they live in these party houses or are they rent? I mean, that's another thing. It's like
brands. Yeah, I don't know. They could be rentals.
I feel like most frequently they are rentals, setting aside like the hype houses or whatever, which.
Yeah.
But I feel like most people are just renting them. Short-term rentals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we don't know what happened at really any of the other parties from New Year's. There were a bunch more that we talked about. We haven't heard of like any of those like influencer events. Maybe they have to have two or three more before they'll get in trouble.
But let's talk about the numbers generally, because this could sort of be related. We're still having huge case numbers, not quite as big as we've had in some like one day totals of like 20,000 plus.
Yeah.
Pretty much every day in the 13 to 17,000 range, numbers that would have been unheard of in like early December, late November before like the Thanksgiving surge. Now that has been just like basically constant.
Yep.
But what has been in decline is the number of people who are hospitalized, which is, it's still really, really high. It's still a terrible situation in basically every hospital. King, the county hospital in South LA, is still in totally dire straits. But the fact that the numbers are not continuing to rise is really good news and sort of unexpected given the case numbers still being really high. We've been speculating about this, just like texting each other, and could be a few different reasons. Could be younger people that are testing positive, which would mean they're less likely to go to the hospital. Could mean we have read that they're sending fewer people to the hospital and getting them out of the hospital more quickly. Mm-hmm. So they've just reached.
But isn't some of that deaths? Because our deaths have stayed between 250 and higher. So that's what one person said.
Daily?
Like, the way you leave now is you daily. Die.
It's been pretty consistently in the mid 200 range for deaths and up to a high of 318, I think. So that brings down your hospital numbers. That's where some people are dying, but a lot of people are also dying at home. Right. But that's the one piece of good news, and that's statewide, that the hospital situation, that, I mean, it is an emergency, is a nightmare, but it could have reached, it seems like it's not going to quite get to New York Spring levels, and that we're not out of the woods for a Christmas surge, but we would have really started to see additional cases by now.
And I want to say too, like when we talk about New York Spring, mm-hmm. they had that this was back at a point in time where I was actually tracking where LA was at in comparison to New York. If we go back and listen to any of those, because we had been saying we're on that trajectory, yeah. we're on that trajectory, yeah. which of course now we can say that we were not. But they yeah. had about a month, I want to say, where they were averaging more than 500 deaths every single day, peaking above 1,000 deaths a day. So at
and that's 200, for New York City, right?
That's for New York City. That's
which is roughly the same population, a little less than
a little
LA
smaller.
County.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah. we were also talking this past week about how we had yet another story about how Los Angeles County has the most COVID cases of anywhere of any county in the country. LA County is, of course, three times the size of the second largest yeah. county. In the United States, the second is Orange County with, 3 million people. So,
we have more people who have not had coronavirus than any other county in the country total.
Yep. If you want, though, a real comparison, because the story this week was LA County passes the 1 million COVID cases mark. Mm-hmm. New York City, which is, of course, composed of five counties for each borough, has about 1.25 million COVID cases. And that is with a population base that is substantially smaller than LA County's by about 1 million people. So
these are and cases in this case is positive tests, because the
yes,
estimate
right.
for LA County is closer to 3.5.
That's
million.
Right. That's right. Yes.
Right.
And it's also bigger in New York, probably similar proportions.
Yep.
Yeah.
Let's check in with law enforcement. A lot of people in law enforcement going, like taking a couple days off in the middle of the week last week for undisclosed reasons, or 2 weeks ago, and then just coming back refreshed from a little vacation that they had. And then getting a call from their supervisors asking why they were out of town and having to reveal that they were in Washington, D.C. to try and overthrow the U.S. government.
Look at this pen. I have Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. Souvenir from my vacation.
First, we got an announcement from LAPD Chief Michael Moore that an employee of the LAPD had been in D.C. for at least the Trump rally. And I wish I'd said this publicly. I texted both of you at the time that the fact that they wouldn't say whether it was a civilian or an officer means it's an officer.
Oh, for sure.
If they would have bit their tongues off in the rush to say that it was a civilian, if it had been a civilian.
And that they said so specifically, he was there, but he left before things got crazy.
Yeah.
Right.
It's and why wouldn't you trust that?
Probably not true.
Even if you do, yeah. I mean, like, even the fact that that's the story that someone is like, oh, no, I mean, like, you know, of course I wanted them to stop
no big
the
deal.
Steal.
Okay.
I wanted to undo the results of the election and to go and vocally support that effort.
Maybe they wanted to go help the police. I think they
that's
went to
right.
go probably help the Capitol Police.
And then we had Sheriff Alex Villanueva announced that a deputy was also in D.C., and they have not disclosed whether or not they were actually at the riot at the Capitol, which to me means they were there. Because, again, they would get that out in the first breath. They would say it before. They say, so they weren't actually at the Capitol,
yeah.
but someone is at D.C. for the rally. But instead, they are withholding that information, which means it is incriminating every single time. So we'll find out details about that lots of, talk to me about officers from all over the country, but also LAPD and LASD talking about this stuff on social media.
Oh my gosh. Like it's like, there's been all this conversation about social media and its role in this and what both the disinformation campaigns, but also like who is sharing it. And do these people not know that we can see their interactions on
social
media?
Especially their likes. I think they don't know.
No, they could not possibly know.
There's a couple LAPD accounts that are very
stupid,
like, brazen, and also the sheriff's department. They have employees that have always kind of been MAGA guys and gals, this whole time. But then there's also just like people who have this very like nice front page of their Twitter, and then you go back to the likes and it is every single stop the steal, propaganda that's being put out there.
I feel weird sharing their identities, although this stuff is public. But yeah, we found a couple of accounts, pretty high ranking officers who I didn't see a lot of stuff that was specifically like the riot was good and not necessarily liking like people like Lynn Wood saying to execute Mike Pence and things like that, but definitely stuff post riot saying that the election was a fraud and like the Trump was right to try and expose this fraud and things like that. And that is my question, is like, where is the line of what it's okay for a police officer to believe that our federal election system is illegitimate in some way, even if they would draw the line at actually storming the Capitol? That's still obviously very scary to me. But I mean, that's being a Trump supporter now, which very high-ranking people in the LAPD are. If you're a Trump supporter, you just believe
and
that.
Remember what they said when they first the day after the attacks, LAPD had a tweet that was like, "We condemn the attacks. We don't know of anybody who has been there and with our ranks or whatever, and we're not going to investigate."
Yes, that's right.
So I guess they aren't going to investigate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's honor system, and we're not going to look at the social media accounts of our own employees either.
So the thing that to me bears mentioning is the account that you guys found that was like the person specifically who was saying that there would be no arrests in the satellite riot here in Los Angeles, right? And that individual was somebody who had liked many different things about the illegitimacy of the election, and so
prior to the riots, but had liked Congress members posts saying like, "Yes, I will be objecting to the results of the election on January 6th, which was the day that they were out there not arresting people for assaulting black women.
So the question of like, when does it become not okay for police officers to hold these views? I mean, pretty clearly it casts a shadow directly on the decision making that happened here locally in LA while this was all unfolding in DC and on our city streets, while we had a mob effectively out for the same purpose, for the same type of revenge, and there's no way to know what the ultimate ends of that series of actions could have been. What we do know is the response of people who believe that this is a legitimate course of action through their own social media engagements. And that, for the LAPD to say that they're not even interested in investigating it tells you most of what you need to know about this story. The only thing it doesn't tell you is how widespread within the LAPD that this behavior is. But I would just say they've given really no reason not to just assume the worst, as far as I can tell. The response has not been encouraging.
And there was also this story this week in The Intercept that looked at groups like anti-masker shopping groups and reopening groups that had been organizing on Facebook and saw that they were getting directly radicalized through these groups to some of the Capitol riot, you know, coalitions yeah. that were going there. And again, we see this here where the police, once again, on Sunday night, the shoppers were out again in the malls mm-hmm. and the police were just letting them go, taking selfies with them again, yep. like not doing a single damn thing. And we now see like some of those people who are at those protests. One of those women is a Beverly yep. Hills salon mm-hmm. owner who was outside of Dr. Frere's house a few weeks ago screaming at her and then was standing on the steps of the Capitol with a megaphone.
Shouting the name of her eyelash business.
Yeah.
If you were to just review, I mean, the behavior of the LAPD in particular, and I mean, obviously this is a long period of time now. It encompasses a lot of different events. But if you were just to look at the LAPD over the course of the past year, which I would say that city government would be well advised to review how LAPD has behaved during the pendency of the pandemic. I think that what you would see is there are a lot that they have been resistant to adopting individual mask mandates, even though that has been something that has come down from the top of the organization with Michael Moore and Eric Garcetti stating on multiple occasions how important it is for police officers to wear masks, mm-hmm. resisting efforts to take the vaccines, resisting calls from the mayor to shut down utilities at party houses. You would see, I think, from a comprehensive investigation that this seems to be like either a substantial lack of faith from rank and file police officers in the directives that are coming down from the top of city government, or potentially also, given that we also know that there's a lot of feeling among the rank and file that they were left to hang in the breeze by Michael Moore and Eric Garcetti during the Black Lives Matter protests of the summer, that they want these efforts to fail, like that they specifically mm-hmm. want to show how politically ineffectual Michael Moore and Eric Garcetti are by just not doing things that they're told to do.
It's only Michael Moore that I know of who has expressed, and it's usually only the chief of police that says this stuff publicly, but has talked about the riots at the Capitol being a stain on the nation and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But did you all see that video of the DC police officer who was, you know, the guy who was crushed in the doors? He afterwards said, if it wasn't my job, I would do it for free. It was absolutely a pleasure to crush a white nationalist insurrection. I, as much as we get to hear of mm-hmm. police political views in LAPD and LASD on the Facebook and on Twitter and things like that, that's not what I'm hearing. And it would be very nice to hear things in that vein. And it is very much consistent with the way they often talk about the efforts of law enforcement in other places. Like, I'm just not hearing that as much, even as much as I am just like general Trump support in social media activity for people in law enforcement. Let's go over to LASD again, a story by Aline Chekmadian this week about the deputies involved, the deputies who shot and killed Andres Guardado. We've talked about that story extensively on the show. 18-year-old security guard shot and killed by Deputy Miguel Vega earlier this year.
You're doing the 2020 thing again.
I'm doing it again. Sorry.
Last year.
A story came out. We had heard about the other complaints about Deputy Vega and his partner, that they had actually been suspended for unrelated to the Andres Guardado shooting. And a really detailed article came out in the LA Times this week by Aline Chekmadian about what actually happened. The story of a 24-year-old skateboarder who Deputy Vega and his partner rolled up on some teens who were also skateboarding. This guy told them to stop. They arrested him, booked him, put him in the back of the cop car, said that they were going to like set him up and like release him into a different neighborhood and say, tell the gang members there that he was a member of a rival gang, so he would be shot. Then they got distracted by some other teens that they wanted to try and like run down in their car. Mm-hmm. They drove the car into a wall at high enough speed for the skateboarder in the back seat to hit his head and bleed. And then they just kicked him out of the car. And there's sufficient video footage of what happened that that Miguel Vega and his partner were suspended for this eventually, but not for 8 months.
Yeah.
During which time they Deputy Vega shot and killed Andres Guardado because they were still on the streets, because they were not suspended while this disciplinary review was taking place. And that indisputably led to Andres Guardado's death.
After all of that, a suspension. After all of that.
A suspension.
Yeah.
Just for, I mean, it still has yet to fully play out what the disciplinary action or criminal charges, if there ever are any, will result from Andres Guardado's death. Mm-hmm. But yes, after all, after that, they earned a suspension.
This is, I mean, I feel like it's worth pausing on this for a minute, because this is exactly the kind of thing, you know, this is exactly the kind of thing that the sheriff's department in particular, but not just the sheriff's department as far as local law enforcement goes, have been doing forever in LA County. This is something that has been done by sheriff's deputies for decades, and it's worth pausing on this because it is always, whenever it's brought up, it is always there's victim blaming. There's, well, you know, if you didn't belong to a gang, then you couldn't be dropped in a rival gang's neighborhood, which is ignorance, willful or otherwise, about what it is like to live in large portions of LA County. There is the denialism of leadership, whether it's the mayor or the board of supervisors or the sheriff, about that belongs to a bygone era of policing in LA. And there's outright just active elision of this story from the narratives that make it to most people. And I feel like that is so important. When we first started talking about the Andres Guardado story, and that this was a kid who was helping out his family, working these jobs, trying to figure out, basically trying to make ends meet with his family in K-Town at the end of the month. And he was in extremely suspicious circumstances, mm-hmm. shot many times, including while he was lying prone on the sidewalk mm-hmm. by deputies. Most people categorically refuse the narrative that there is any chance that these deputies instigated an untoward series of events that directly ended the life of Andres Guardado. Even mm-hmm. people who believe that the shooting was unjustified, by and large, are looking for some sort of middle ground narrative in which Guardado was in some way a participant or inviting actor in his own demise. And
yep.
what we see from this narrative preceding the Guardado shooting, preceding his death, is these are deputies who show a clear, active, and decidedly malignant attention to the lives of Black and brown Angelenos. People who are not just trying to jeopardize the lives of people, but actually, you know, they are saying, we're going to get you killed because your life means nothing to us. And the Guardado case should absolutely be colored by that. We know this about these deputies.
And meanwhile, the primary debate that we're having with law enforcement at the city level right now is whether or not they're going to get a raise this year or possibly next year.
Yeah.
That's like, this is the line that we're fighting on right now. We have, and this is a good segue to stuff related to the budget crisis in the city of LA or what's left of it. Almost every city employee union, it has delayed the raises that they were due for this fiscal year to next year, which will save the city tens of millions of dollars. The LA Fire Department Union made a deal this week, similar to what pretty much every other city employee union has done, with the exception of the LA Police Protective League. That is by far the biggest line item in the city budget. Their raise is worth tens of millions of dollars just by itself. And they're saying, no, we are not going back to the negotiating table. We are going to keep that raise. And they're using the fact that $150 million was cut from the police budget to justify that decision. At the same time, it's getting harder and harder, I think, for the city to claim poverty with the money that is potentially coming from the Biden administration. If you look at this $1.9 trillion relief package, the money that we talked about for state and local governments that did not come in the last package is right now in there. It might get negotiated down. It might become something else. But it's for money for state and local governments is $350 billion. Proportionally to the population of just the city of LA, that's a little over $4 billion.
Right.
And that's for that's a combination of different things it can go to. You're allowed to use it for vaccine distribution, for COVID related, like to keep workers employed, for testing, for schools, but also to, quote, maintain vital services, which is just patching the holes in the budget. It's kind of free for all money.
It's free for all, but it is. I mean, typically what we've seen in previous bailout packages, both during the last recession and earlier in 2020, was that this sort of bailout money typically comes with strings attached in the form of it's use it or lose it. Like you have to use it, generally speaking, within like the calendar year or something like that. Of course, sure. We don't know what those conditions will be, but just looking at the model of recent history, we can sort of expect that there will be some urgency that city government needs to basically, like, they need to be ready on the day of receipt to start parceling out the funds,
right,
to avoid this whipsaw of going from we don't know how much money we're getting to suddenly, oh my God, we have all this money and it expires 3 months from now or whatever.
Right. But just like making the checkbook balance for the city of LA, that money is ready to spend.
Sure.
Like they just won't make the cuts that they were going to make and just absorb the money from the federal government. And so like the combination of that, things are already getting cut. It feels like the $15 minimum wage is the first thing on the chopping block, which for city of LA doesn't matter because we already have that at least coming. But the increased unemployment aid to $400 a week through September, another $25 billion in rental assistance, which is the doubling what came in the last package in December. This is if this happens, this is a big deal. I'm sorry. I understand that people were really focused on the difference between $1,400 more dollars or $2,000 more dollars. The other stuff in this package will make untold much more difference than that $600 difference. The increased unemployment alone was transformative at the beginning of the pandemic, and extending it through September is a giant deal. The child tax credit, huge deal. Like it could easily be watered down, and it may not pass in this form. But like the entire relief package, and it, like especially if it's the beginning and more is coming for the rental, for the rent debt crisis in LA, for the like people that have for families here, for the budget crisis. If it comes out anywhere close to this form, to me, it's a giant deal.
Yeah.
No, I,
what
I,
do you all?
I,
yeah,
I agree. I think when I think about the immediate aftermath of the pandemic, the first the CARES Act being passed in spring of last year, what really ended up, I think, being the most impactful in terms of the durability of the changes that were made by the government, what ended up being the most impactful were increased unemployment payments and the deferral of student loans. Like, at least when we're talking about for the age bracket, including everybody up to and including Gen X, I think that really was transformative for people. When the expanded unemployment payments ran out, that was when things really started cratering for people, for individuals across the economic spectrum, because there's not really, you know, there are a lot of people whose jobs have just vanished.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of other people who would be much safer if they did not have to go to work, frankly. So this is what is, I think, desperately needed. A one-time infusion of cash is in a limited sense, regardless of what the final number ends up being of those payouts, cannot be as effective as those sustained ongoing expansions of the welfare state, which is really what is needed, I think, in this moment.
Yeah, and we said this before last week or something, but like the city and county have hinted again that like, oh, we might have more restrictions might be coming.
Yeah.
It was a convoluted reasoning because it was like, if things get as bad as they did in December, well, they were bad in December, but we didn't make any additional restrictions. But you do get a sense that they're waiting to see if people have these payments in hand, if there's this national mask mandate that's going to be, you know, dropped down as like some kind of like 100 days of getting this over with or something like that. You know, maybe that will be part of, you know, more restrictions and closures that we'll see.
What I think too, what I think needs to be part of the conversation in California in particular, where housing costs are so high, are and have been at crisis levels even prior to the pandemic, is when we are discussing rent relief, when we're talking about $25 billion, is that right?
$25 billion more. We got
and then doubling it, right?
Yes.
That what we stand to do and what city leaders should really be advocating for, I haven't heard anybody really doing this. What we stand to do is have a lot of that money siphoned off directly into higher rent payments, in particular, once the Ellis Act is back in force. We don't know when that's going to be locally. Mayor Garcetti has suspended enforcement of no-fault evictions during the time period of the emergency order. Probably the best single action that he's taken since the pandemic started. But at some point, the Ellis Act will return to being the law of the land and effective in California. And probably the longer that this goes on, we will see more real estate lobbyists trying to sue to end that particular provision. The reason why is because the Ellis Act is an effective tool for forcing people out of their homes and thereby circumventing existing rental protections, and the people who have then left that housing have to go find housing at a much higher rate somewhere else. So even if we are using our rent funding to pay back rent debt that has accrued or things like that, we, I think, are at a period where we should start really be thinking about what is this city going to look like once the evictions kick into high gear? We know that that's coming. How can we best protect people from that? Totally full disclosure, This is something that's very likely going to happen to me in the near future. I've been posting on Twitter about my situation with my landlord who's selling our apartment building. We have no real reason to believe that our new purchaser is not coming in with the intention of quote unquote going out of the rental business, which is of course the Ellis Act language. This is something that's going to happen to a lot of people, and a lot of people who are in much more precarious situations than myself personally.
But that happening all at once, which when you have this huge backlog of people that want to sell their buildings, renovate their units or whatever, when you have a huge number getting no fault evicted on those grounds, that's a huge issue. And to me, like, those kind of protections and getting this money to people, I mean, like, it's at the county level, it's going to be close to probably $1 billion that's coming just for rent relief. But how that's distributed is we don't have a great system for it right now. Last time the LA City did rent relief for the CARES Act, it was a lottery. And so there were lots of people that really, really needed it right then that just did not get the money at all. Like, how do we set up systems to allocate this money? And there's a lot of it available, to me, is the focus, rather than in the immediate term trying to get more. It's protecting people from like eviction in the short term until the relief can get to them, and it's getting the relief that is available out as efficiently as possible and doing the outreach. People do not know that they are protected. Right now, they're getting exploited. They're getting evicted illegally. They're not being made aware. And there's a huge amount of graft.
Yeah. The federal government should be doing it. I just want to be totally clear about this. The federal government should be doing this. We talked about last week, the federal government, I think, Hayes, you said, should just be the money hose, and local governments should be distributing it. But the graft, the inefficiency, and frankly, the garden variety incompetence that characterizes American municipal governments, I don't think is something that can be overcome, at least not in the short term. And we're seeing that with the vaccines, right? Like, the federal government should be administering this program. That's clearly not going to happen. It hasn't happened with the $25 billion that we just received. I don't see any reason to think that that will change, but we don't have good administrators in the city of LA. We frankly do not. And I would not be surprised to see yet another lottery as the solution here.
So let's talk about what is going to happen on Wednesday. Let's look ahead to this week. Predictions. We had the council meeting on Wednesday canceled on Inauguration Day. There have been protests in Sacramento, I think, every day since the election, basically. And there's lots of National Guard people there. Alyssa, what do you think is going to happen?
We also know there's going to be an anti-mask mall attack on noon on the 20th, as advertised by their completely open to the public Facebook page.
Do we know which mall?
Keep
an eye. All of them.
They said somewhere in mid-city, which makes me think that they don't really understand where things are outside of Beverly Hills. So I just think it's significant. I keep bringing this up because it's the same people who are, you know, we're down in front of City Hall. You know, it could be a major action, and seeing how the police respond to it will be very interesting to watch here. The other thing I have my eye on, of course, our local ties to national news is Eric Garcetti is the chair of the inauguration, which has now been really has become just like a military parade, I guess. Not even a parade, just a military show of force in the Capitol and some Zoom concerts. So I don't know. I guess I'll be looking to see what actually comes of it. I guess it will be a healing event is what it's being billed as. So, and a lot of local celebrities like Tom Hanks is hosting. So the first coronavirus patient seems so appropriate.
I love the jokes about that Garcetti was the one that like made the lineup for the performances and like chose the Zoom backgrounds and things like that. instead of what I'm sure he actually did, which was just ask a lot of people for $1 million. Oh, let's talk really quickly. We were all sort of like stunned by this. What Alyssa, I think you said would have been a huge story any other time. Barbara Boxer is getting a little of her money back from the inauguration committee. Why?
So complicated. I can't even have to look at the story to remember what it even was about. It was. I mean, this is just like the tweet that like is from Axios. Axios?
Mm-hmm.
Biden's inaugural committee will refund a donation from former Senator Barbara Boxer after the California Democrat registered as a foreign agent for a Chinese surveillance firm accused of abetting the country's mass internment of Uyghur Muslims. Like, what?
There's so much in there.
There is a lot in there. Like, I mean, what? Where she worked. So the company, the Chinese surveillance firm is called Hik Vision, H-I-K Vision. And,
okay.
Yes. And... I mean, like, sort of buried in that is, like, the company that she works for is a very powerful California lobbying firm called Mercury Public Affairs, which Villaraigosa, lots of other former officials have worked with Mercury, which is partnered with all kinds of ghastly global forces. They had to, they finally, earlier this year, ended their contract with Turkey, after the support, their support of the war against the Armenian people in Azerbaijan, after a lot of lobbying. But Barbara Boxer works for them to contract with this Chinese surveillance firm and lobby to Congress on their behalf. Probably, so I don't think that's like
plenty of post-employment opportunities for people leaving. Yeah. California legislative posts. No worries.
Meanwhile, Scott has been posting on our website, thelapod.com, about Councilmember John Lee's new information that we all knew already, that he is city staffer B, the person that joined former Councilmember Mitch Englander on trips to Vegas and got illicit gifts from a cabinet maker, and what's the upshot of what did we learn, Scott?
Yeah, well, so I'm gonna have more coming about this story, but the basic information that we got over the course of the past week comes from filings in advance of former council member Mitch Englander's sentencing, which is scheduled right now for January 25th. They've had a number of different scheduling dates and have pushed it back in the past. It's possible they could do that again, but this flurry of activity makes it seem like it is probably going forward. Now,
this guy, nobody benefited more from this pandemic than Mitch Englander, who was arrested or pled guilty on what, like March 11th or something like that?
The day after the show.
Yeah.
I mean, so we have new information that comes out of that case indirectly. The United States case against Mitchell Englander, as listeners may remember, might need to go back to some earlier episodes of this show. But what happened in that case was Mitch Englander was charged in an indictment with a variety of different charges of lying to federal investigators and witness tampering. He ended up pleading guilty to one count of basically scheming to manipulate a federal investigation, mislead investigators through his conversations specifically with Andy Wang or Andy Wong, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, who is the cabinet maker who was trying to get in big with the developers in South Park, downtown LA.
And only was not charged, by the way, with corruption and bribery charges because it seems like he did not hold up his end of the deal. He got paid, but their case was that he didn't actually get this cabinet maker anything substantial, or didn't use his government position to get anything for him.
Yeah,
and so that part is all legal. It's only the lying to federal investigators that he's being charged with, right?
Yeah, and Mitch Englander appears to have been
collateral damage. Like
he
essentially was, I don't know, walking through the cafe when the shotgun blast of the federal investigation went on. And he just happened to get, because they were, lest we forget, the FBI were actually present observing this Las Vegas trip that Mitch Englander and John Lee were both present on. Mm-hmm. They were there, presumably following the actions of one George Esparza, who has also pled guilty to a RICO charge. Now, that is much more central to the bulk of the investigation, which, as we know, is centered directly around Councilmember Jose Huizar and Ray Chan, formerly of the mayor's office. So what we learned in filings this week is all a result of the fight between federal prosecutors with the U.S. Attorney's Office and the defense attorneys for Mitch Englander, who are squabbling over what sentence is appropriate to Mitch Englander's admitted crime.
And whether he should go to jail at all.
Which the U.S. Right. probation office is saying he should not. And the defense is saying he should not. And the prosecutors are saying that he should be imprisoned for a period of 2 years and also have to do, I think, 400, maybe 300 hours of community service. He is currently slated to do none of that. He would be on probation, no community service, no jail time. As listeners might expect, I am not, this is a rare position for me to be in where I would be saying prosecutors might have it right here. And also, I think just in general, the prosecutor's response is always going to be to ask for more jail time. But the case that the prosecutors have made in their filings is actually pretty compelling when they say that all that the defense and the government have shown so far is that Mitch Englander is somebody who has overcome a challenging childhood background and become rich and powerful and used his power in ways that are not deserving of the public trust. There is a two-tiered system of justice if we say that somebody who does not have access to all of the resources that Mitch Englander currently has access to deserves a slap on the wrist for contributing significantly to fraying the trust of Angelenos in their government. But as part of that, as part of this back and forth whereby the defense was putting out all of these letters from family members, I love my dad, etc., please don't do this, it was just one mistake, what's a massage lady anyway? As they were receiving all of that testimony, including from Ed Reyes, former council member and chair of Plum, who, if it were me, I would just stay the fuck out of it. I would not volunteer myself as a character witness. As they were doing that, they apparently annoyed the U.S. Attorney's Office, who released a transcript of a conversation between Mitch Englander and a confidential human source. We know this person to be Andy Wang, our business person, the cabinet maker. If you are a member of the Sepulveda Pass, our Patreon subscription, you might have had the opportunity to hear us during the holiday party have guests reenact portions of this exact conversation. This is the famous conversation where Mitch Englander and Andy Wang drive around downtown Los Angeles. Mitch Englander turns up the radio in order to thwart any listening devices. It turns out Andy Wang, according to FBI investigators, had usually two different listening devices on him when he was having conversations with Mitch Englander. And in this much longer transcript of their conversation than what was released as part of the indictment or plea agreement, Mitch Englander talks about, he is coaching Andy Wang on exactly what to say. They are talking about an upcoming interview. It would have been Mitch Englander's 2nd, I believe, interview had just happened, and they're coaching Wang for his upcoming interview with the FBI. He is, of course, cooperating. But Englander says, here's what you say if they ask about why it took me so long to pay you back. Here's what you say if they ask about the escorts that I hired at the end of the night. Or, sorry, the escorts that Wang hired at the end of the night. And in conclusion, he actually says, okay, so if they ask you about debts that I owe you, or that me and John, specifically that John Lee and himself owe to Wang, and why it took so long for you to get reimbursed, the goal was for Wang to say it took so long because it wasn't important to him to get repaid, or he didn't know mm-hmm. how much he should be repaid. But Englander very clearly identifies, quote, John. There is no other person who could meet all of the descriptions of City Staffer B and also has John Lee's same name. It would be very convenient if there were. But somebody who had his same dates of employment, who had his same high rank as is mentioned in the indictment, somebody who has admitted that he was on this trip, as John Lee, of course, did, somebody who was interviewed in July and August of 2017, again, as John Lee has admitted that he did, and also to be named as specifically owing and not having paid back Andy Wang. The bombshell here is we no longer have even the whisper of a doubt for the equation of City Staffer B to John Lee. There can really be no doubt anymore that this is the case. But I want to be clear about what that does not tell us. First of all, it does not tell us that John Lee will ever be charged with federal crimes by the U.S. Attorney's Office. In fact, mm-hmm. I think it's highly unlikely that he will. Again, we are looking at a prosecutorial structure that views mm-hmm. wins and losses very much in terms of time served. And Mitch Englander, then a city council member, was a side target at the time. According to Mitch Englander's lawyer, they didn't even know that he was a target of the investigation until 2020.
Mm-hmm.
John Lee, decidedly not on the radar. We can see that from the fact that John Lee was interviewed July and August of 2017, and then never again. Mitch Englander was interviewed 3 times going up to the end of December 2018, and he continued to lie and lie and lie to federal investigators. But John Lee, I think if we can say that with a greater degree of knowledge about Mitch Englander's actions, and also with a greater opening to use his public official status to corruptly benefit his friends, now the USAO is struggling to get any period of jail custody for Mitch Englander. Yeah. I highly doubt that they will look at John Lee as something worth pursuing here.
So any accountability is going to be up to his peers, right? It's going to be up to the city council, as Scott called into a meeting the other day to say, no one has mentioned the fact that you are sitting next to, or on the same Zoom screen as someone who is involved in this federal investigation, has now been proven to be, to some extent, complicit in a cover-up
yep.
of that, of the illicit gifts that he and his boss had received. To me, it's like, I understand why a lot of people on the council are not, you know, there's a lot going on, and I understand why they're not, like, forcing the issue on this, but I do wish that more people like Scott would, like, and whether it's journalists or anyone else, would ask them about it.
Yeah.
Would make this into, you know, like, a former council member is being sentenced next week.
Yep.
This is a good opportunity to put some people on the record about what they think about this, because history shows us with Jose Huizar that they won't say anything until they're absolutely forced. Yes.
Until they have to.
The very
yeah,
end.
Yeah, I think,
yes.
You know, I think it behooves us to be really careful here, because, and specifically because, we want to be really clear about
who we're holding accountable and for what. So what we have is not proof that John Lee engaged in a cover-up. However, what we have are charges that allegations that John Lee engaged in a cover-up, co-signed by his former boss and good friend, Mitch Englander.
Yes.
Mitch Englander said in signing his statement of facts, these are the things that happened. I coordinated my answers in FBI interviews, despite having been asked not to talk to anybody, with John Lee, who had also talked to the FBI. I then used that to coordinate Andy Wang's answers so that I could mislead federal investigators. Mitch Englander has said,
and I backdated these checks to also mislead.
He did all of those things. Also,
investigators.
Also,
so did my staff member.
And yeah, so also there are backdated checks received in the same envelope. I think pretty clearly indicating close cooperation between John Lee and Mitch Englander in order to provide the appearance that they had intended to repay benefits that they never intended to repay.
Right.
They, in all likelihood, in doing this, did not violate federal bribery statutes. That I think is something that is pretty clear at this point. They could have, but were intercepted at a point in time where, you know, by virtue of timing or whatever, we'll never know, that did not rise to the level of violating federal bribery statutes. Otherwise, very likely Mitch Englander would have been charged with that and was not. However, what we can say is city council has no interest in knowing the truth about this. And we can see that because their response has been, and John Lee's response has been, we need to let the federal investigation play out.
Right.
If John Lee is not charged by the federal investigation, that means that he is given a political clean bill of health. Not
they haven't said that, but that is what we can assume
that's
going
the
to be.
Yeah, that's
never charged
being
with anything,
done.
Whatever.
Yeah. So we need to, I think, be very clear about what our expectations are. And the expectation should not be John Lee is going to get charged by a federal grand jury, because that's unlikely to happen. That does not mean that he has behaved in such a way that the public should trust him. That does not mean that he didn't use his position of authority within Mitch Englander's office to get benefits that I think anybody would reasonably agree to be a corrupt sort of side hustle on the side of his official day job in the council office. So I think that we should be very clear that the expectation is city council needs to prove to Angelenos that they are capable of policing their own. This is something they have never done. And and the expectation needs to be, regardless of what comes out of the federal inquiry, there is enough information about John Lee's conduct while he was working for the city that there should be some sort of investigation into what he has done. And pending that, he should not be in a decision-making position. He should not be serving on committees. He should not be doing these things. And
especially the Plum Committee.
Especially the Plum Committee.
Right. Yeah.
Which is really
the most openings for corruption.
The fact that Nuri Martinez, council president, has reappointed him to the Plum Committee shows that, in my opinion, shows a real sense of the impunity with which council continues to see themselves with respect to this investigation and all other complaints originating from the public. I think we had asked, will that change with Nuri's election, or not with Nuri's election, with Nithya's election in particular? And I think pretty clearly that it has not. They do not see the public as a source of any power that can be exercised over them. And that, I think, needs to change.
I do want to talk about one thing that Scott highlighted from the Mitchell Englander documents that were revealed, which was testimony from Sean Penn on Englander's behalf, asking a federal judge not to send him to jail.
Mm-hmm.
He told a story about the Woolsey fire in November 2018 and how his neighborhood in Malibu and Point Doom was being threatened. And so he was trying to get back to his house. A lot of it is redacted, but it seems like he was trying to get home. And then he happened to run into Mitch Englander at a gas station, who I guess he recognized or something, or like, I don't know exactly how they got to talking, but Mitch Englander, a lot of it is blacked out again, but appears to have made some phone calls to allow Sean Penn to get home or to otherwise have his house be checked on. The stuff that's blacked out tends to implicate other government officials potentially who are like, hey, I'm this fire chief or whatever is like not interested in being involved in this narrative. And by the way, Malibu is not in the city of Los Angeles. It is a different place.
Yeah. I mean, that whole part was so weird. Like, help me. He really helped me a lot.
Sure.
Not anywhere in his jurisdiction or anything. Like, what was he even doing on that side of the hill?
Why was he in Malibu?
Day?
Sure. Like, I think his district was actually being threatened at that time.
Yeah. Your district was on fire. Like, go back to your district.
But longtime listeners might remember, is this that same story? Didn't we hear this already? No. That was a completely different story about Mayor Garcetti making calls on behalf of another wealthy, possibly a wealthy, famous person. Also does not live in Los Angeles, lives in Ventura County, and who sent 56 texts with the fire chief to get their house checked on. Same fire, different counties, neither a house in the city of Los Angeles.
Love it.
These are what our city officials were spending at least some significant amount of their time on during this really, really scary, dangerous fire. And Sean Penn's letterhead is ridiculous. Thank you for listening to LA Podcast. Thank you for subscribing to our Patreon at patreon.com/LA Podcast. We have our Double Indemnity episode going up this week. We have an episode of The 10 with Mitra Juhari going up this week. And thank you to Brian Holmes, as always, for producing the show. We'll be back next week. Bye. I wonder what is going on here. Is the space hell or is it past?